Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Contemplations of the Lotus Eaters. This is a show where Josh and I try to stay clear from current events and the hot politics and try to instead focus on topics and discuss topics that we think will be interesting and valuable to you, our viewers. And before we start today, we want to say a couple of things about the organization side of things. So I'll give it to you, Josh.
Sure. So I wanted to take more steps to interact with people in the comments and kind of spark discussions about things, because I've noticed that there are lots of interesting points raised about these episodes we've been doing. And I thought it'd be good to kind of change the tone a little bit. And also I want people to recommend topics more to us. So if you have any ideas for topics, you can email me at josh@lotuseaters.com and Hugo at lotuseaters.com as well.
Yeah, and so I'll be aiming, and I think you'll be aiming as well, to kind of read the comments definitely on our site, so lotuseaters.com. There we read all the comments and try to respond to as many of them as we can. And so we will be happy to have a discussion with you there about whatever we talk about.
I'll also be commenting on YouTube as well, but Hugo doesn't want to do that. But that's just additional, something that I want to do on the side. But on the website, both of us will be replying, just to be clear.
All right. So today we'll be talking about artificial intelligence. And we'll be talking about that today and tomorrow as well, but we'll be taking it from different angles. And so today we're going to start with artificial intelligence today and in the future, right?
Yep. So we've had some kind of interesting predictions about the future. Obviously, you've got to take these with a huge grain of salt, because there's kind of a notorious history of predictions being wildly wrong. And, you know, how people believed that there'd be flying cars in 2021. And that's clearly not happened yet, unfortunately. And nevertheless, I feel like these predictions show us the trend in which experts in the field expect things to go. So the first one is about narrow AI, which is a form of AI which is focused on completing one task. This is like a computer that solves mathematical equations or something like that, where it's focused on doing one thing, and it's very good at doing that one thing, and it doesn't really do much else. And the prediction was based on a survey of 100 of the most cited authors in AI, and this came from 2013, and they believed that machines can carry out most human professions at least as well as the typical human by about 2070. And although this date varied to a great degree, and some people were saying, well, it's not going to be until like 2300, and that doesn't make sense, 2300, whereas others seem to think it's going to be sooner. So with the nature of any prediction, the boundaries are very rough, But nevertheless, this is something that we're going to be trending towards.
And I mean, you said that this will be a situation where AI can carry out most human professions at least as well as a typical human being, and maybe better, right?
Mm-hmm.
But so this can also vary across different tasks and different professions, right? So
sure.
it's not just that we can say, okay, they will be able to do everything, and therefore we can at least have some point on which we can you know, agree and then pick a date where we think that's going to happen. But it's not like that. It's all over the place, and it's going to be sure. different in each field and in each task.
Right? Like a Tesla is a good example of how an AI is already better than a human driver, because the AI makes far less mistakes, more fuel efficient, drives better. And that's a good example of a profession where perhaps a chauffeur, taxi driver is going to be taken over by AI, whereas more complicated things like, I don't know, creating art, I imagine, isn't going to be taken over by AI anytime soon.
Like making a podcast about AI.
Yeah, that too. Thankfully, hopefully we're not going to be out of a job very soon. But there are cases where even in like the 1980s, they were using computer programs to fulfill similar roles. And I remember an example of there was a computer program which essentially asked people, it just said the same thing back to them, but as a question. So they would say, oh, I'm feeling really bad today. And then it'll reply back to you, you're feeling really bad today. And it just asks questions, and it was very primitive, but even the people who used it kind of became engrossed, even though it is very, very simplistic. And they said that they felt a lot better talking to this machine, even though it was virtually meaningless.
So it's like artificial validation.
Yeah, it really is.
Like, I'm feeling sad. Oh, really? Oh.
it's kind of a bit depressing that exactly, a computer yeah. can fulfill this role where human beings could do far better. But nevertheless, this is something that is probably going to progress. But thankfully, I've not become a clinical psychologist, so I'm in no danger here. So another prediction, which is equally as kind of ambiguous and should be taken with a huge grain of salt as well, is that it was predicted that by 2075, computers will be as smart as humans, and by 2105, we will have super intelligent computers that will be smarter than humans in every way, which is known as general AI, which is an AI which has an intelligence which doesn't necessarily specialize on one thing, but it has multiple abilities, as you could probably guess by the name.
Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt, but I think this is an important place to kind of pause and consider what the differences between those two things are, and that
sure.
the differences are quite significant from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you have narrow AI that is really, as you said, focused on that one thing, one task that it can do really well, and often it can do that thing much better than humans. But then you have general AI, which would be something that can do a wide range of things, and it is not necessarily limited to one kind of task that it has. And that general AI could also one of the things that you could do would be to improvise and to adapt to different circumstances, which narrow AI cannot, right? And so, mm-hmm. so that's one of the defining characteristics of general AI. And something like general AI doesn't exist at all. That's sci-fi at this point.
It is, yeah.
But there is a lot of narrow AI that is much better at their specific tasks than humans even now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're talking about AI, we need to kind of separate that discussion mainly like, when we're talking about AI today and where it might go in the near future, we will be talking about narrow AI, because
yeah.
that's what's relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're having the discussion about dangers of potentially super intelligent AI, there's going to be a discussion about that kind of general AI that no one actually knows how that will come about. And people disagree. Up to a recent past, people actually disagreed on even on whether it will actually exist at some point. And now that discussion is kind of over. Most people agree that it will probably come at some point, but no one knows what it will look mm-hmm. like or which kind of AI will evolve into this general AI in the future. And so that's what the discussion is, and this separation between what we have now and how it works and what is being speculated on in the future.
Sure. And there's something that I will get onto later, but I see no reason why there's anything this sounds really bad, but anything necessarily unique about the human brain, in that you can probably recreate a comparable intelligence in a computer, because the human brain is just a collection of neurons which communicate with electrical signals, and that is how everything emerges. So if you operate on a similar principle in theory, you're going to be able to get to the same point in a computer as well.
And I think later on you have an example of this, right?
I do, yeah. Okay. But I don't want to spoil it now.
Foreshadowing.
So the current benchmark for computational intelligence is known as the Turing test, which comes from the English mathematician Alan Turing, who originally called it the imitation game. And he is widely regarded as the so-called father of computer science and artificial intelligence. And he was known and was most famous, certainly in the UK, for developing an electromechanical machine, which was responsible for breaking the Germans' naval cryptanalysis key, which was instrumental in defeating them in the battle for the Atlantic. And just as a little kind of tangent, a professor who studied Turing's work suggested that Turing helped shorten the war by 2 years and potentially helped to save 14 million people. And you're probably thinking, well, why is this relevant? Well, this kind of goes to show that developing a computer which is vastly better than that of your peers will clearly give you a huge advantage in the world. And there's very heavy incentives for governments to follow this. And the implications of it being developed by governments and not a collaborative effort is something that I will get into in tomorrow's episode. But I don't want to go down that rabbit hole just yet. So the actual Turing test itself involves a machine's ability to exhibit intelligence that is equivalent or indistinguishable from a human being, and would involve a conversation between an actual human being and a machine with establishing a human-like response.
So just to make it clear, the test is whether the machine can successfully pretend to be a human to the point where the real human cannot tell.
Exactly. So the way that works is that there's typically an evaluator who's typically referred to as person C, and then they're trying to establish whether player A or B is the human or the AI. So they have a choice between the two, and they've got to figure out who's who. And at the minute, the test is only limited to text channels, because if it were through a machine's ability to actually, you know, turn these programs into audible words, it would be limiting, because our ability to do so isn't very good. So you'd be able to tell immediately, like, everyone's heard the Microsoft text-to-speech. It definitely doesn't sound like a normal human being.
And yeah, and even, like, even different, you know, platforms or venues, how you could do it, like, that's not mm-hmm. really, that's not really relevant right now. Everyone will be yeah. able to tell. It's that's the area of robotics includes software, which may be better, but they include hardware, which is like that interface is not really at that point yet.
Yeah, and it seems like an unnecessary distraction. There's also the kind of frame of reference issue, where most people, when they're talking, there's an emotive kind of drive to the nature in which they talk. So the tone would be very kind of neutral and sound very strange from a computer, because it doesn't feel emotions, obviously. So that would also be a huge giveaway, because a human being would give away how they're, just by the manner in which they're talking, which I mean is no surprise to anyone, I imagine. So if the evaluator can reliably tell machine from human, then it is classed as failing the test. However, if they cannot distinguish one from the other, then that is being... I can't speak. If they can't tell the difference between the two, then that is classed as passing the test. And Alan Turing at the time of kind of coming up with this test had kind of came up with the idea that if around 30% of the time you can't tell the difference, this is the kind of threshold that we should aim for, at least at first. Which
so that was his threshold, right?
Yeah.
That's what he said when he was designing this. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So he was the person who set that. And mm-hmm. I think he said, if you can tell them apart 70% of the time, so it's kind of like the remaining 30% mm-hmm. is the part where you cannot distinguish. And I find this a little bit strange that it's 30%, because it seems rather arbitrary to have it at 30. Why would you not have it at 50? Because then at least you've got a kind of an understandable cutoff where if it can't be distinguished the majority of the time, then yep. you would say, okay, then you pass the test. So I'm kind of a bit skeptical at the 30% cutoff that we currently operate on, but I suppose it's not worth setting targets that we can't actually meet yet.
I mean, especially when he was doing it decades ago.
Yeah.
And the state of computing was in a very different place than where it is today. Mm-hmm. So that would be something that would be an ambitious goal back then, because you could say, okay, clearly everyone can tell that what we're making now is not a human because it's doing very rudimentary stuff. But that's not where we are. I don't know, 70 years later, 80 years later.
And speaking of which, I wanted to get into where we are actually at in artificial intelligence development in terms of the Turing test. So in 2014, there was kind of a controversy because many claimed that a program passed the Turing test in an event organised by the University of Reading, which was held in London. So the computer program was called Eugene Gustman, which simulated a 13-year-old Ukrainian boy, which seems a bit like cheating, doesn't it? Like, if they're simulating a child, the conversation is going to be limited already. So, a bit of a tangent. But this was created by Vladimir Veselov and Eugene Demchenko, who were Russian and Ukrainian, respectively. And they used the same threshold which was set by Turing, which was the 30%, and they used the keyboard conversations to avoid the pitfalls of an auditory conversation. And in this test, the program convinced 33% of the judges, which was only 10 people, so it's quite a small sample, at the Royal Society, that it was a human based on an unrestricted conversation. So they didn't actually have any topics set. They could ask it whatever they wished, and it still convinced 33% of people.
How was it 33% when it was 10 people?
As in, the 33% represents 10 of the judges.
Oh, right, okay, yeah. So there was 30 judges.
Yeah,
okay.
And these results were kind of looked at very critically because they only talked to this AI for 5 minutes, which is very superficial. You'd think that if you're trying to understand a complex conversation, 5 minutes is only a very limited amount of time to be able to differentiate a human from a computer. Although, that being said, it's still quite impressive that they can do it immediately. Like, I don't want to necessarily denigrate the achievement, because I was quite impressed that they got to that point already.
Yeah, I mean, also, it is impressive, but as you said before, the 5 minute conversation is something very limited, especially when you have to the program has to pretend that it's typing, you know, and like delay things, and the conversation is happening in real time, right?
Yeah, because
there are these kind of limitations.
If the messages just came through instantly, like it would with a computer, it'd be a dead giveaway. So there's got to be things in place that make the competition fair for the judge.
I feel like the important thing, the important point of criticism in this, which there are several, some of them you've already talked about, but I think the most important one is that they pretended that it was a child. They modeled a child, which limited the scope of the conversation to something more simple, something less kind of thorough, something right. Like if you're speaking with the child, you're not aiming to have a conversation that's as deep or as complicated as the one that you would want to have or aim to have with an adult. And so you would talk to the child differently, and you would expect them to respond differently. And so that can limit this kind of the level of complexity that you need to have to be able to fool the one that's evaluators.
That's exactly the argument that many of the people in the artificial intelligence community suggested. And they also pointed to the fact that earlier in that year, there was something known as the Loebner Prize, which the AI finished seventh after a 25-minute long conversation. So it seems like the time limit and the fact that it was being framed as a child probably helped it in this particular case. But it seems to me that there are probably AI that are objectively more convincing than this one. But it's the first example of a machine actually supposedly passing the Turing test, although it's quite a controversial one. And it's some people have been celebrating this and saying it's a great victory. Others have been saying that this is ridiculous. And what on earth are you on about? Why would you even consider this as a reasonable thing? And I think I side more towards the latter than the former, but I still think it's quite impressive that people could be convinced even after 5 minutes.
I mean, we've all enjoyed like 10 years ago, whenever it was the Conversation with God, or like that website. I don't know if you remember that or if you know about that. It was
I never heard about that.
Oh yeah, that came out, I don't know, about 10 years ago, as I said. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's still online, I don't know, but it's just Conversation with God or Talk to God or something like that. You'll be able to find it, I'm sure. And it's just you asking things and God responds to you in a way that you'd expect God to respond to you. It's quite funny. But it's considering how far AI has progressed since 10 years ago until now, this is not the area where I think that would be that relevant, right? So if they're pretending to be a human and to speak to someone, that's one type of skill, you know, fooling humans into thinking that the program is human. But at the same time, you have a lot of AI that is very good at something but is not good at pretending to be a human, and it's a good benchmark in one way, but it's not something that can tell us completely about the state of AI overall, right?
Sure. So an AI's usefulness isn't determined by how human it is necessarily. The whole reason that developing artificial intelligence is appealing in the first place is because it has the capacity to be better than a human being in some areas. So if the benchmark is just human intelligence, it kind of makes it seem like, well, what's the point then? We've already got human beings. It's not like there's a shortage. Do we really need them? But
no, yeah, you're completely right. And even one step further, right? Not even human intelligence, but making people think that you're a human, right?
Yeah.
Even though you don't necessarily need to have that level of intelligence in any way, but you have to be very skilled at fooling people. It says that's the kind of quality. And that can be like hard to do and an accomplishment to actually be able to create, right? But that's not to denigrate it, but that's a very specific thing that is not very useful in some other ways.
It's also a really weird selection process because you're essentially teaching AI to be as deceptive as possible, which is like the worst thing you could possibly want to do, right? Like, if we've got these potential threats in the future, like basing the early development upon how easily it can deceive a human being is kind of a terrible benchmark if you think about it. I hadn't thought about that until now, yeah. But it's kind of ridiculous, actually.
Like, we can talk about them more tomorrow.
So I wanted to get more into what's in store for the future, and there are lots of competing strategies, and the kind of computational science side of it, I'm not going to go into as much because I'm certainly no expert, and I'm sure there are people people know far better than I and have better information about that. But there is something I'll get into which relates to my field of psychology very well, which many people, even in the machine learning and artificial intelligence community, may not be familiar with. But to start with, the current strategy that most people developing AI are using is trying to develop the narrow AI focused on a specific task, where it approaches tasks like calculating large strings of data and can be more effective than a human being, as I touched on earlier. So these computers rely on logic to navigate huge stores of information and can calculate things like probabilities and take shortcuts, or mental shortcuts if you really want to put it that way, which humans cannot. And this means that they're faster and more efficient than human beings in some cases. And this is why they're particularly useful. And that's also why I think the self-driving cars from Tesla are better drivers than human beings, because the reaction time side of things is what holds people back in the safety aspect, which is why these cars have a very high safety rating, because human beings' reaction times are relatively slow in the kind of vast scope of what's possible, especially when you're driving like 40 miles per hour. Don't know what that is in like kilometers, I'm afraid.
Around 60. Wait, yeah, so especially you said the speed of reaction, but also the narrowness of focus which humans have. So a computer can observe much better things all around it, mm-hmm. and can react to everything that it sees, rather than just to a narrow kind of sliver
That's
of information.
A good point, actually, because human beings have a very limited attentional capacity, whereas a computer with the limitation is only the hardware. So as long as you have enough hardware, a computer can focus on all of the sensory information that's fed into it in a more objective way than a human being. And you've got phenomenons in human psychology like inattentional blindness, where people will miss things which, if they were looking for them, would be completely obvious, but because we have our attention directed elsewhere, we miss things that seem obvious. And the example is there's an experiment of some people playing basketball, and then a person in a gorilla suit walks through the middle of the screen, beats its chest and walks off the screen, and only like 25% of people actually notice this happening.
You could actually show that on the screen, so. Okay, but this is one of the things that can be very useful in, right? So so taking things that humans do, like driving, where you have a lot of inputs and your brain as a computer is not exactly that good in taking all those information and making sense of them in real time and figuring out what the best solution, yeah. quote unquote, is. And so this is something that the computers can do very effectively. Mm-hmm. One problem with it, or one kind of key area of it, is computer vision and kind of taking those inputs and making sense of them and figuring out like what's an object, what's a living thing, what's dangerous, what's not dangerous, things like that, and what is what, actually, so that the computer can see very well then. But that's an important part of it, but that's a hard part of it. That's mm-hmm. much harder than taking, I know, lots of like dry data that you have, like numbers, then crunching those numbers. That's very easy to do, but very hard for humans. But for humans, it's very easy to look around and make sense of what you can see, but that's much more difficult to imitate.
That's because our the human perceptual system is linked to our memory. So we don't need to look at a table and think, oh, this has got like, it's made of wood, it's got grains, it's kind of flat, it kind of looks like a table. Like, we just look at it and we know it's a table, and that's because we've got it stored in our memory what a table looks like. And it sounds almost ridiculous to say it because it's so obvious, but it's something that quite often gets forgotten, that our perception and our memory are so intrinsically linked that a lot of the time we don't actually need to really pay attention to what we're looking at to understand what it is, because we're already familiar with a lot of the objects in our environment.
Yeah.
And that is the difficulty with an artificial intelligence, is that it's got to not only be able to see things but comprehend what they are, be able to recall the relevant information from memory, which is the difficulty, I think.
Oh, sorry. That's also one thing that is related to how AI actually does things, or one specific type of AI that we implicitly meant now, mm-hmm. is that humans learn just by taking some limited amount of information, limited points of data, and then extrapolating from them and making them more conceptual, mm-hmm. and creating templates from those. And then you have a template of a chair in your head. It's like the Platonic thing, but like it's something like that, but like not philosophically.
The theory of forms, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. But and so in practice, the human brain actually does something like that, right? So you take some limited amount of information and you create like mental constructs out of it, mm-hmm. that can then be applied to more information to figure out what that thing is that you see. But computers can't do that very well, or AI can't do that very well in this format. So mm-hmm. it does it differently usually. So a lot of AI methods, what they do is that they take huge amounts of data points and then feed them to the program. And based on that huge amount, the program actually learns what the different things are and is able to then construct new things. If you ask that program to generate a chair, it's going to generate a chair, but not from some kind of template of a chair that it has, mm-hmm. because it has seen a chair before, but because it had been fed tens of millions of chairs, of pictures of chairs, and then it can crunch those things in a smart way that I can't describe.
This is why Google uses the capture system to identify whether you're human or not, and gets you to identify like traffic lights or zebra crossings, or I don't know what they're called in, like the where people cross the road.
Yeah,
it's got a different name it's got a different name in America, doesn't it? I've forgotten what it's called though. Like crosswalk, isn't it?
Zebra crossing, right?
That's in the UK. It's like a cultural difference.
Oh yeah, fire hydrants. Yeah,
fire hydrants as well. John says,
and it's interesting to see that you can kind of observe how good AI is becoming and how it's getting better and better just by these like small capture things, because mm-hmm. a few years ago it was like, okay, just like write down this word that is kind of written in different colors, that's mm-hmm. it kind of bamboozles the AI, and so okay, type the word and it's fine. And now it's like, okay, here you've got these 50 images and pick out the canoe, yeah? and then you have some bushes, you know, and you can't even tell there's a smudge, and you don't know what the canoe is. Like,
yeah. Sometimes it bamboozles me, to be honest.
Yeah,
like
exactly. So often you can't almost do it. Like it's mm-hmm. it's and that's because it's becoming so good at identifying things, that you need to make it that difficult just to make sure that what is responding as human.
It's almost so difficult sometimes that it really gets on my nerves. Like I'm just trying to access a website and I'm having to click on these pictures for like 2 minutes, and it's just, if this is our future, I'm gonna be very disappointed. Just constantly pressing pictures for about an eternity.
No, you need the digital ID.
The internet.
Yeah. You have a digital ID and it's fine.
Anyway,
I'm joking, by the way. I think that's a terrible idea.
Yeah, please don't do that. Anyway, I think we went on a bit of a tangent there. So one of the other strategies is known as deep learning in current AI development. And This is where AI is able to learn without human supervision, and it draws from data that is both unstructured and unlabeled, and it builds connections between that. And the data sets are often massive. And in an example, you could detect things like money laundering and fraud in a banking company through certain patterns that can be detected by machines, but not human beings necessarily. And if you've read the book Super Freakonomics, they also give the example of how they looked at terrorists' banking information to look for certain patterns, which allowed them to identify, I think, 5 or 6, which is still like very few and obviously a huge breach in privacy, and I don't necessarily agree with it, but at least, unlike some programs, I'm looking at you, United States, it actually found people.
And like the TSA molesting you.
That's what I was trying to allude to. So yeah, machine learning is another strategy which has a self-adapting algorithm that gets increasingly better as it is fed with new data that gives it experience to analyze things like patterns.
And the interesting thing in this kind of field is what's called neural networks, and that's kind of a method that's used in AI. And that's a method where you have some inputs, and you have a lot of those inputs, and you know what those are, and you can label them, and you have outputs as well. And so you teach that AI to make those connections somehow in the middle, but you can't see the middle. You know, it does something, but you don't really know what it does, because that's unintelligible to humans. That's something that the computer can understand, but that doesn't make any sense to us. And so it can then take some things and churn out some other things that you need from it, but it does that through a process that you have no idea what it did, because it made sense in some way to that computer, but not to you. And that's kind of making patterns, making sense of those things that you feed it. But it's in a different way that a human would do it, just because a brain is not a computer, or not this kind of computer.
That sounds very confusing to me. I can't really comprehend it, to be honest. But something I can comprehend is something known as whole brain emulation, which is an alternative strategy, which is very kind of fringe. And I imagine that a lot of people don't really know about it, but it's particularly interesting to me because it connects to cognitive neuroscience, which is something which I'm very interested in. And it is, the end goal is to get a computer to simulate the entire human brain. And the kind of rationale behind this is that if you can simulate a brain in a computer, if you scan the structure in detail and have software which can model it so accurately that it's faithful to the original brain, and when you run it on the appropriate hardware, then it will behave as more or less the same. But right, obviously there are lots of caveats there and limitations doing this.
So the idea is that we know that brains work because we do things, and
I don't know about brains working all the time.
And so you have brains, but you don't know how they work, because that's a lot of it is just a mystery to us still.
Yeah.
And so if you take those brains that you know work but you don't know how, and you create the same thing artificially, it should work in the same way.
Even if we don't understand it.
Even if you don't understand how. So you don't need to actually go into the details of the program to make sure that it does things properly, because it should do things on its own, just by its design, because you know, because that's what it does if it's in a human. If sure. I understand that correctly. I
yeah, that, that's you, perfectly right.
So that's, I'm just confirming. My, what
it... So the idea is that if we can't understand the human brain and we're very far away from doing so, we don't even have a concrete definition on human consciousness yet. We can't agree on what criteria defines human consciousness. We don't know roughly what we should include and what we should exclude, although there is some degree of an idea in that human perception, attention, memory, and action seem to at least be some key components in human consciousness, but it's not clear which ones are the most important, which ones are the least important, and whether that's all-encompassing or whether there's more stuff that we need to discover. So the limitation on this is that we simply don't have the understanding, as you're saying.
And so is the limitation just about the understanding, or is it also about the design? I know, of course, you can have brain scans and you can have, you know, a lot of information. You have a lot of information about what the brain actually looks like. You can cut into it if someone's dead. We can actually look into mm-hmm. what it looks like actually in the flesh, not necessarily just on the screen. But is that enough? Is that enough to be able to construct a copy of that brain virtually?
I think they rely on neuroimaging techniques, because what they're trying to imitate is the neurons themselves, mm-hmm. rather than the physical structure of the brain. And because the neurons are the key component here, the actual structure is just a way of supporting these neurons. And they're taking a neuron focus rather than just trying to recreate the physical structure.
Okay. Yeah.
And we'll see that in some of the projects I'm going to cover mm-hmm. here.
Okay. All right.
So the first one and the most promising one is known as Blue Brain. And it is a brain research initiative that is seeking to digitally reconstruct the brain of a mouse by reverse engineering mammalian brain circuitry. So they're starting with a mouse because it's got a more simple brain than a human, mm-hmm. which is relatively intuitive. You would imagine that before trying to simulate a human brain, you would want to take something simple but comparable, which is why they've taken a mammal that is relatively simple in its structure.
Is that a brain of a mouse?
I think so, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it doesn't look very similar to a human brain, does it? But it has structures that are comparable, and it doesn't necessarily need to look physically identical if the areas do more or less the same thing, mm-hmm. because the basic principles remain the same no matter how the structure is. Like an organism can have a different shaped skull, and it makes their yeah. brain develop differently. It doesn't necessarily mean that the functions are going to be any different.
Yeah, like for people who have I don't know, like difficulties during that childbirth or something like that, during like being born, mm-hmm. and that the head might be deformed in some way, and it doesn't, the brain kind of adopts to that. It doesn't need that shape or
yeah, that's known as neuroplasticity, where mm-hmm. The brain molds to the functions that are required of it and its use. But I don't want to go off into another tangent. So this project has been going since 2005, and they've been using a supercomputer, and they've got this massive room where they've got this huge computer, and it runs a software simply known as Neuron, which is an environment for simulating and modeling individual networks of neurons. And they actually have had some promising results. So the first significant breakthrough is in 2018, they released a 3D brain atlas, which provided information about the cell types and the number of cells and the positions in 737 regions of the mouse's brain. And in 2019, they managed to map the entire cortex of the mouse's brain, and they were able to complete a virtual EEG experiment, or at least begin that, sorry. But they proved that it was possible to do this, and an EEG is electroencephalography, yeah. which is just like a neuroimaging strategy.
And so they put that, they applied that neuroimaging strategy to that virtual model of yeah. the brain that they had built.
Just to see if it works.
Okay.
And they've kind of hit a bit of a brick wall recently, because the model has become too heavy for the supercomputer to handle, so they're trying to work at new strategies to make it more efficient. So The difficulties are still very stark in this method. They have a supercomputer which takes up an entire room. They've not even simulated the entire mouse brain, and obviously a mouse no bigger than your hand. So we've got a long way to go.
And so this is really interesting. I didn't know about this before we started talking about it now. But as I understand it, this is kind of a fringe project, fringe approach yeah. to AI. This is not what most of the AI community or the people interested mm-hmm. in it would do, because like it's something that can be appealing and that we can talk about better, especially you when you've mm-hmm. got expertise and it's similar to what you do with real humans. But this is not necessarily something that most people in AI are focused on or would be trying to do, right?
Sure. And it's not necessarily as laser focused on developing artificial intelligence. I think that part of it is understanding the brain of mammals and how these can manifest in the thoughts and behaviors that they do, because we still don't understand that. And in simulating it in a computer, we might have an environment where we can have design experiments which don't require an endless supply of mice and the moral implications of animal testing. And you've got lots of history of studies where they do lesions in the brain of certain animals to understand what the damage to certain areas does, and therefore what the role of that brain area is. And that's still one of the best strategies we have to understand the human brain. But as you can probably imagine, the limitations of this are that if you damage a brain, it messes up how the brain works. So it's very difficult to generalize about these findings. But there are things where, for example, damage to the prefrontal cortex, which is here, can change your personality. And we've had enough human examples of that to know with a certain amount of reliability that this is the role that this area serves. But if we're able to model it on a computer, we can just run a simulation, and then there is no limitation to how many times we can run it. And therefore we could run it thousands and thousands of times to see whether this is a reliable thing, in theory at least, because we're not there yet.
So it would be useful for this kind of research of the brain. You wouldn't mm-hmm. have to use real brains and damage real brains in order to find out information about how the brain works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because particularly with human beings, we're mainly reliant on people who've had like medical accidents and things like that. Obviously, psychologists aren't going around damaging normal people's brains anymore. To study them anymore. Even in the past, I don't think they did that. So it is a pretty immoral field, but even the psychologists of the past did have some degree of limitation, thankfully. Although okay. I imagine there are a few that are a bit upset about that. But
well, anyway.
Moving on to another project, which is the Human Connectome Project, which hasn't necessarily got any results quite yet, but they're seeking to provide a compilation of neural data and represent this graphically. And they're currently looking at how they can go about doing this, and it's more about the logistics of doing so rather than actually coming up with any results yet. And another one is www.brainpreservation.org, which is trying to use the tools that we have available at the minute to look at genetics, molecular biology, biotechnology, microscopy, systems biology, data science, and other fields to uncover the epigenetic, extracellular, and synaptic changes that form the molecular basis of memory. And I don't think I could have got more buzzwords into one sentence. And
you think YouTube algorithm works like that?
So that the final aim of this project is to be able to preserve memories and identify what role memories serve, and be able to copy them across digitally and preserve people's memories and identities in machines.
So it's like loading your brain up to a computer, right? That's the idea.
It sounds quite sinister, doesn't it? But I think the idea is more about preserving human memories and the human brain, and they frame it in such a way to suggest that that when we look back at ancient cultures, we feel like, oh, why did they not preserve more of their history and culture? And we feel like it's a huge loss, which it certainly is. And they're saying, well, isn't the human brain something that's very important to the time that you're living in as well? And if we have the ability to do so, why could we not try and preserve people's memories and identities from the time to... is almost like an archive for the future, right. Which sounds kind of sinister, but not quite as bad.
It's probably worth saying that if you made a copy of your memories and of your identity, like that of your brain, it wouldn't, like, that wouldn't be your consciousness.
It wouldn't be you.
That's a side note or a tangent a little bit, but that's the problem with teleportation, right?
Yeah, that was what I was going to say.
So if you deconstruct a human at one place and then construct it back at the other, it's not certain whether that would be the same consciousness or another consciousness, because at what point does it stop being you? Right. And that's a problem, right?
Can you disassemble your atoms and reconstruct them again?
Yeah.
In a way that still preserves who you are. Yeah. Like, it seems like the process of shrinking a person down in that way would then eliminate their existence.
Yeah.
And then recreating them again, isn't that a different person?
And the kind of spooky thing about it is that you wouldn't be able to tell, right? Because, like, for that person coming out of the teleport, like, they would have the same memories. They would say, okay, yeah, I'm alive, I'm here. But they could be a different person, and that first person they got into the teleport could have died, and you would never know because that person would be dead.
This reminds me, this is a little bit of a tangent, but there's something known as, I think, imposter syndrome, where people believe that their relatives have been replaced by people who are anatomically identical and have the same memories as their relatives, and they are actually able to make the distinction that these people aren't the same, even though biologically and technically, yes, they are the same, but it's not the same person. It kind of drives them mad, and there are cases in the United States of people, like, escaping their families and never talking to them again because they believe they've been replaced by the government and stuff like that.
UFOs.
Yeah, it is normally... UFO related, I don't necessarily believe that's going on, just as a caveat.
Yeah, but I mean, this is a real problem with the idea of a teleport like that, right? Mm-hmm. So that you could have a person, like, dying on the front end and a new person coming to life somewhere else, and that person would, like, honestly, sincerely say, I'm that person, you know, and they wouldn't know, and no one else would know, right? And so you wouldn't be able to tell.
But if you can't tell, is it really a problem?
It is, because if you get into it, you die. It's a problem for you before you get into the teleport, because you're going to die.
And on that horrible dilemma, we're going to end this episode, and make sure to tune in tomorrow where we talk about the potential dangers of a super intelligent AI.
Yeah, and if you like this episode, go to lotuseaters.com, where we have other episodes of the Contemplations of Lotus Eaters, and we also have lots of content, both free and premium. If you want to support us, subscribe to for a premium account. We start at £5 per month, and so you can support us that way. I'll see you there.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21+. Terms and conditions apply.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard. for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.